You will recall that we hit a translation difficulty with chapter 2 and verse 8, and I suggested I try to do some study on that this week, and I did, and it was really quite fascinating. I couldn't recall if I'd come up against this before. I've reached that age where you're forgetting so frequently, you know, you don't know if I never knew that or if I didn't, I forgot. I think from this point on, I'm going to claim, well, I knew that, I just forgot. And so, you know, I'm brilliant. But went back and looked at this verse 8 because of the question of how to translate that last phrase, particularly the pleasures of men, which in the New American Standard then has a big dash. It says, many concubines. So I went through quite a number of sources, as a matter of fact, and then sort of summarized several of them, one of which I thought I would read to you mostly in toto, from Adam Clark's commentary. Adam Clark, of course, very, very famous commentator, and he says this. In the brackets, he has musical instruments. Remember, that was the question. Some had musical instruments in the place of wives and concubines, or many concubines. And so the question was, well, how can that be? And so he has musical instruments, and that of all sorts. And then he says, for these seven words of English, there are only two in the Hebrew. These words are acknowledged on all hands to be utterly unknown, if not utterly inexplicable. Some render them male and female captives. Others, cups and flagons. Others, cooks and confectioners. Others, a species of musical compositions derived from a celebrated Phoenician woman named Sido, to whom, and he gives the guy's name, a historian I can't even pronounce, whom attributes the invention of music. And by the way, was it a Phoenician woman named Sido who invented music? Genesis would tell you something very different. We're told Jubal was the one, you know, that invented musical instruments. But others, to continue the quote, with more probability, wives and concubines. And if these be not spoken here, they are not mentioned at all. And that had occurred to several of the class members, I think, last week, too. You know, we had pointed out, well, it would seem odd to have musical instruments there. And if so, then in a list of all the pleasures of the flesh, to not have sexual activity involved would be a pretty glaring omission. And so he is suggesting here that, you know, it would be unlikely that it would be instruments of music. As a matter of fact, many of you would have heard of the duo Kyle and Delitzsch, who are very famous and extremely scholarly, detailed, boring, difficult to read commentators on all the books of the Old Testament. And they were just death on the idea that this had anything to do with instruments of music. They said that really is just completely impossible. The words never mean that. But the problem here is that these words do not occur anywhere else in the Bible. And so you have to go outside the Bible to begin with, and then when you do, you get these varying different translations. Another commentator, as if that first list of possibilities was not long enough, said that it might be translated litters and coaches, remembering that a king would be carried on a litter or in a coach, so it would be thinking in terms of pride and glory, you know, and ostentation and being carried around. Others have translated it baths. He took a lot of baths. Okay, so then it would have to do with hot tubs, I guess. Some have translated it treasures and chests, which would have to do with, you know, treasure chests. And if you can imagine, some have translated this demons. Demons? And I wanted to give you the list just to show how extremely difficult it is now, 2,900 and nearly 40 years later, to translate this particular phrase. It just happens to be one that we've lost sight of in three millenniums. And so we just have a hard time translating it. However, I did note that the great majority of both Bible translators as well as commentators lean toward concubines as a single word or wives and concubines to account for the two words. And so it does appear to me that that's more likely. You're all aware that I'm a big fan of the New American Standard. I think it's the best translation you can buy today. I think the New King James is great, but the New King James is just what its name suggests. It's following the King James, and you got the instrumental music translation from the King James. They're the guys that did that, and so then it gets followed in the New King James, and others have picked it up since that book's been around for 400 now in 5 years. And so what to tell you, it is just one of these very rare places where you have to say, I don't know. Jerry, go ahead, please.
As you indicate, the New King James follows the original King James with musical instruments, but in the margin of the New King James, there's a little note, exact meaning unknown.
Okay. So the New King James, they admitted this is just a conundrum, and nobody really has an answer for it. And that's the best answer I could find, was that we don't know. Now, again, I don't know how you could possibly overemphasize this. Whenever there is a question about either the transmission of the original texts, so whether or not a given word or series of words belongs in the Bible at all, or if we're dealing with a translation difficulty where we're really sure these are the words, but what do they mean, does it ever matter when you have these questions? And the answer is a resounding no. And never, because the context will still solve the problem, or some other Bible book will have a passage which solves the problem. There will be reinforcing evidence so that, ultimately, there's not a direct contradiction. There's no less confidence in the Bible. There's no less faith that should be offered by us before our God, because we have a very, very, very few of these difficulties. And in this case, let's just admit that the New King James marginal reading is absolutely correct. We don't know. Okay? So now, we don't know what the last few words at the end of verse 8 should be translated to represent. Does it change your understanding of Solomon's thought even a little bit? No. Because this is a whole list of what? Say again? There you go. And I was going to say, it's a whole list of examples. And then I was going to ask examples of what, and Lee was going to answer. The pleasures of the flesh. And so he already made his point in the unquestioned statement that he had set out to experience everything that a human body and mind, all senses, could possibly find to enjoy. And then he went about listing a bunch of them. Well, is it incumbent upon Solomon to list everyone known to man? No. They are just representative examples. So, if you happen to be a person who really thinks that among the greatest pleasures of the flesh that there is bathtubs, then that's the one you should pick. Okay, because his point is, it's the pleasures of the flesh. And as a matter of fact, are there not varying pleasures distributed among human beings? Do we all experience exactly the same desires? And be careful with that, because I could prove something. Do we all in the flesh experience exactly the same desires, and take the same pleasures? No. And in point of fact, when it comes to sexual activity, what's the verse that proves that there's quite a variety? 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And when Paul says that he wishes that all men were like him, was he saying unmarried? Or was he saying that he had either a lack of sexual desire or a higher degree of sexual discipline? But either way, then he ended up with the statement about gifts. Not all men have what? He said, referencing himself, not all men have this gift. Okay? Now, you don't have to talk to very many people to find out, you know, for some people, money is a terrible problem. For them, you know, it is really a fascinating thing. And they have serious issues with it. They have a grand temptation to greed. Others, money is just of such little consequence. They really don't care. And they can get themselves in trouble financially because it is just unimportant to them. And so Solomon was not trying to make a list, and it doesn't need, you know, of everyone, and it doesn't need to be precise. The blanket statement that he tried every pleasure of the flesh that there is answers the whole problem anyway, and then we're just left with a little problem of, you know, how to translate the last few words. Okay, so now that will bring us to chapter 3. We start tonight with Ecclesiastes 3, and this is, as a point of fact, the third longest chapter in the book. Seventh chapter will be six verses longer, but or seven verses longer, I guess. And so tonight, though, I think I'm going to go ahead, even so, and read the whole chapter, seeing that in these first nine verses, they're particularly short, and so I don't think it's going to take too much time. But I often find that if you don't read it all at once, it's easy to miss certain themes or contexts, you know, or what is revealed in the context. And so if we just go line by line, start working through it, you know, it doesn't have the same impact, I fear, anyway. So let's start then. Everybody turn to Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And as always, I'll be reading from the New American Standard. There is an appointed time for everything, and there is a time for every event under heaven. A time to give birth and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to uproot what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to tear down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw stones and a time to gather stones. A time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. A time to search, and a time to give up as lost. A time to keep, and a time to throw away. A time to tear apart, a time to sew together. A time to be silent, and a time to speak. A time to love, and a time to hate. A time for war, and a time for peace. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? I have seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything appropriate. The marginal reading, actually more literal, is beautiful. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in their heart, yet so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in one's lifetime. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it and there's nothing to take from it, for God has worked that men should fear him. That which is has been already. That which will be has already been. For God seeks what has passed by. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. I said to myself, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every matter and for every deed is there. I said to myself, concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there is no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward, and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? And I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Now, having read the whole passage, let me ask, are those first 9 verses about a time for everything the only section in that chapter that deals with that thought? See, it's not. There's at least 2 more verses outside that section that talk about things in their time. And it's my conviction that Solomon has a theme throughout this chapter, in that it's pretty easy for us to sort of look at it in sections like they're isolated from each other. We really don't think that they are. Now, it's true, though, that you can pick out different sections, they're a complete thought in and of themselves, but there seems to be a larger theme that's holding everything together. And what's happening here is that, now, with the conclusion of chapter 2, let's read those last 3 verses now, there's nothing better for a man to eat and nothing better for a man than to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. Have you heard that recently? Does that ring a bell? Didn't he say the same thing in verse 13 in chapter 3? Didn't he essentially say the same thing in the last verse of chapter 3? He's telling us how to be happy in this life, and that there is nothing better, and he's had it all, than for a man to eat and drink and tell himself that his labor is good. This also I've seen, that it is from the hand of God. Now, let's just stop again. We ended with this last week, but we're going to start with it today because it's part of our theme. What is the best thing you can do with your life? Eat, drink, and talk to yourself. Tell yourself what? What is good? Now you've got it. I just want to really emphasize it. Tell yourself that what is good? Labor is good. What is good? Well, I thought it was to be avoided at all costs. We're all looking for cushy jobs where there isn't any, so that we can then leave our cushy job and go on vacation. No. Labor is good. And Solomon is intent on really pounding that idea into our heads, because it's going to come up, already has. It is now, it is twice in chapter 3, and it's going to come up several times more. It really matters to Solomon that we get that. When you are sweating, when you are working, when you are performing what we typically would think of as an unpleasant thing that we can't wait to get done, we're missing the point. The labor in and of itself, that's good. Not the result of the labor. Now, there are results from labor that he's also going to commend. He was real happy that he was the wealthiest guy on the planet. He enjoyed all those pleasures, thoroughly. And he told us about money in Proverbs. He's going to tell us about money here, being a protection in all of that. But what he wants to focus on before you get to these first 9 verses is that labor is good. And apparently, if I'm gathering what he's saying right here, you need to tell yourself that. Why? Because we don't think so. It's the natural human experience to try to avoid it. We want leisure. We want comfort. We want inactivity. We want to just sit and enjoy life, you know. And Solomon is saying you're missing the point. So you better start instructing yourself, telling yourself with great frequency as he does in the book. Working is its own reward. Working is valuable. Working is right. And working, the word that he uses so many times, is good. And you better tell yourself that, because you're not going to think so. You're going to have to persuade yourself, convince yourself, change your own mind to appreciate that fact, and now get out and engage in it some more. Now with that thought, you go to 25. Who can eat and who can have enjoyment without him? And that's without God, the last part of verse 24. For to a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, while the sinner, he's given the task of gathering and collecting, so that he may give to one who is good in God's sight. This, too, is vanity and striving after wind. And that is where I ran out of time last week. So I didn't really deal much with that last verse. Think about that for a minute. Solomon says, I have discovered and I appreciate, and I want you, the readers of my book, to understand. To a person who is good in God's sight, and I have every conviction that all of you here, you wouldn't be here unless you had this mindset. You're good people. To a person who is good in his sight, he has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. What is good? Your labor. So that's a joyful thing. If you have the knowledge and wisdom that it is good, you will take pleasure, satisfaction, enjoyment in that labor. But he gives them the task, he gives those blessings to them. And then it says, what does he do to the sinner? He gives the sinner the task of gathering and collecting so that the sinner will do what? Give it to the good guy. How many of you think you're still waiting for that bad guy to give you the good stuff? When is that going to happen? Okay. Well, good question. I suppose that's what Solomon's trying to say, is that they are to be our slaves, you know, and so they're going to get out there, you know, and write us checks and you know, come to our door and say, well, I understand you're a good person. I can see it in your life. And so, you know, I'm a sinner, and so I just want to give you this stuff here. So you say, fine, you know, and I get out there and make some more. It isn't going to work like that. Now think, how does this work? It does work. It was working then. It's working now. How does it work?
We're all sinners. We all labor for someone else.
Okay? Flesh that out a little for me. We are all sinners, but here's the contrast between sinners and good. Sinners collect to give to the good. When did that ever happen for you? Let me ask you this way.
you know, don't give me a number, but percentage-wise, which is the bigger group, the sinners or the good people?
Sinners.
The way it's straight in, and few there are who find it. The much larger group is doing for the good of the smaller group. Frank, you on the trail here?
You ask, how do you get it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one good way is to start asking God for it.
It is. Okay, but see, in the passage, he's saying it's the sinners that you're giving the good. Now, you're right. All right, we start with God. That's his plan. Now, they have to do the mechanics of how that plan works. Jimmy. Okay, and now we're starting to get to it, and our first example did too. Okay? Now, just to summarize everything, I am absolutely fascinated by how America works, and it isn't by trains, and it isn't by planes, and it really isn't by boats, because we're not a nation of canals. How does America work? Trucks. If there is any possession you own, it was on a truck before it got to you. And we know that all truck drivers are faithful Christians, aren't they? Okay? Well, no. Now, all I'm trying to do is to just think of different ways this can be true. So in one sense, you know, I actually wrote this example in my Bible right here. I love computers when they work. I have some of the world's worst luck with that, but by the way, all last year, I bought one of those neat machines to feed the receipts in. You know, you see advertising on TV all the time, and they make all those reports for me. I fed that machine all throughout 2014. I really was ready. It's my first full year. I'm going to make this happen. And then came January, my computer melted down, and guess what went with it? Everything that I've done for my taxes in the whole year. Still gone. So I want to qualify when it works. When it works. But, you know, we all know that the only reason we have computers is because Christians made them. No, and automobiles, they exist because only Christians are in the assembly line. No. God looks down at the world, and this is the broader picture. So that's one example. Now I want to step back to either another example or a broader picture. And now we get to where you all started. It starts with God. Now I want you to think about his attitude. God looks down at the sinners and the good. And what is he thinking about all that he's doing down here? What is he doing? He's wanting you to be happy. He looks down at all those sinners who will not serve him, and he sees them as delivering to you the goods and services that you enjoy. As God looks down at the world, he sees the sinful people as the servants of the righteous people so that we'll find pleasure and satisfaction in life. So there's a number of different ways. What I'm saying is I've struggled with this verse for years now. I've come up with a couple of different ways to try and understand. I've never had a sinful person walk up and say, here, I want to give you money because you're righteous. I don't think it means that. So I'm giving you a couple of different examples. But I think ultimately, it's God looking down at the earth, Solomon figuring it out. Who does God care about the most? Righteous people. And what does he want for you in this life? A happy, enjoyable, satisfying life. And he's going to let you understand pleasure comes pretty naturally. I don't wake up every morning and I can start telling myself over and over again, you know, please your senses, because it really will be good. I have to tell myself, work hard, because your labor is good. Okay? God understands certain things you take pleasure in naturally. Other things you have to work at, you have to be informed about. But his whole attitude is, God wants you to know it. And when you look out at the world and you think everybody's against me and God has forsaken me and why doesn't this happen and that happen and everything else, you remember this verse. God is saying to you that no matter what is going on in your life, he is in control and the sinners are out there because he is using them to serve you. And they may have a wide variety of uses, but that's the way God is viewing the world. You are more important to Him. He wants you to enjoy your life.
Is so self-evident, and you take verse 2, so pardon me, there's no way I can escape this, I guess, because what I want to do, but, you know, not, no pun intended, is there labor in birth? Okay. But is there labor in dying? Sure. Is there labor in planting, but no labor in harvesting? Well, there's labor. Is there labor in killing? Is there labor in healing? Is there labor in tearing down? Is there labor in building up? No matter what you're doing, there's labor.
What did he just tell you at the end of chapter 2 about your labor? Get up every morning and tell yourself, it's good. It's good. So whatever category you find yourself in at a given moment in the first 9 verses of chapter 3, what are you supposed to be telling yourself? It's good. And what does it take to get there? Wisdom, knowledge, peace, joy. It was joy. Sorry. It's joy. Okay?
So now watch what happens at 9. What profit is there to the worker from that in which he toils? This is all about labor in the various times. I've seen the task which God has given the sons of men with which to occupy themselves. He's made everything appropriate, right, beautiful. That is just the most beautiful war I ever saw. Why? War is never right. Wait a minute. Solomon just said sometimes it is. Now, the biggest question of them all, and we'll just stick to the war thing here at the end.
Pick any war going on in the world right now. Anyone. Tell me who God wants to win and why. Now, if you have any wisdom or knowledge, what do you respond? I do not know. So, which side's right and which side's wrong? And which side should we be fighting for and supporting, and the other side we should be insulting and hoping to kill? Do you ever know? Brother, I suggest no war ever fought did anybody know what God's plans were. How many times in the end result have things happened and we realized that it was all just backwards and cattywampus and upside down of what we thought that it was? Okay?
So, next time you hear somebody here in America saying, you know, and God is on our side, what do you know for sure? They haven't got a clue. Nobody knows. We're going to get to that real quickly. So, keep reading. Now in verse 11, we've got to finish it. He's made everything appropriate in its time. And he has also, and here's a translation difficulty. I kind of like it one way and not so much the other way, but there are two totally different ways to translate this. The one I have in the New American Standard is, he made everything appropriate in its time. He's also set eternity in their heart. Yet, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. Now, before I give you the alternate reading, which you've probably seen already in the marginal notes, but if that's the appropriate and proper and best way to translate this verse, then we now learn that God puts eternity in your heart. What does that mean? And I think that is the absolutely the most powerful force on earth. Oh, what was the name of the book by Viktor Frankl? I read it several times through the years, and now I can't remember what it was. It's about a man in a concentration camp, and he tells the story of what he's experienced. And in his story, that is the opposite of Solomon's. Look up Viktor Frankl. It's F-R-A-N-K-L, a German guy. And there's only one book, I think, you know, that'll pop up for sure, and it's bound to be in print, and whatever it is, buy it and read it, because it's really good. But what he experienced was the exact opposite of what Solomon experienced. Solomon had everything in that concentration camp for several years. What did Viktor Frankl have? Nothing. And then he'll explain to you, all else just fades away except one thing. You will forget all about sex. You will forget all about
that house you wanted to build. You'll forget all about the places you wanted to go and visit, you know, on vacation. Then just one thing in a concentration camp, when all of your life has been stripped away, there's only one thing left, and what is it? You want to live. That's the most primal thing in the human experience. And you'll sacrifice anything for it. Most people, in every kind of dignity, they'll give away. Okay? You will resort to cannibalism. You want to live. And I believe that is eternity set in the heart of man. We long to live like nothing else. Okay? Was that 127 hours? Did any of you watch that? What was the matter with you? I couldn't stand it if I wasn't that. 127 hours. Guy had a boulder fall on him when he was climbing in Utah, I think it was. James, you watched it, did you? Okay, in Utah. Okay. 127 hours that guy was trapped. And what did he finally do with a dull pocket knife? Yeah. Okay? Because you want to live. Okay? Now back to the passage. In verse 11, he has also set eternity in their heart. Do you want to only live here under the sun, or do you want to live longer than that? Everybody wants the eternal life as well as physical life. Yet, so that man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. So the last part will say, hungry as you are, you know, for life and the understanding of life, there are some things that God will do what with? He'll conceal them from you. Now, when it comes to eternal life and God's whole plan for scheme of redemption and what heaven's going to be like and all the rest of that, we learn an awful lot, you know, in our Bible. But at the same time, it's not near enough, seemingly, is it? What do you know about heaven? Not a whole lot. And what do you know? How many times have you read a Bible book and it still left you with questions? They don't necessarily answer every question. Only the ones God wanted answered. So the point is, hungry as we are for life, as much as we think about it, and all the speculation that goes into it, there are secret things that belong to God. Right in the margin, Deuteronomy 29:29. The secret things belong to God, but the things revealed to us and to our children. Deuteronomy 29:29. So that's the way I've always understood the passage. That's the way I usually teach it. And my point there is that as a matter of fact, everybody is hungering for life to such an extent that I think you also cannot avoid the question of whether or not there is a God. I believe that is a part of our primal nature. So people either seek out that truth, as you do, or they learn to shut their consciences down, sear those consciences, you know, turn away from their God. But he puts it in our hearts to seek after him, to answer that question. May answer it properly or improperly, but God is pushing, motivating. Now, if you have a marginal reference, though, it says, I'll read the alternate, he has also set eternity in their heart, without which man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. That is an equally valid translation. It's not a more or less literal one, it's just an equally valid way to translate it. Now, if that's the way that God intended, then I'm going to read it again. He has also set eternity in their heart, without which man will not find out the work which God has done. Now this really says exactly the same thing I've just proposed, which is, answer this question. What is the driving force in the human being to find out whether or not there is a God? Eternity in your heart. The desire to live, not just physically, but eternally. Jimmy?
Isn't it King James that says,
have
set the world in their heart?
He set the world in their heart?
What am I going to do, you know, to get you guys to quit reading that King James Version?
It throw me a curveball every week.
I don't know how to answer that. He set the world in their heart rather than eternity. All right, well, back to the drawing boards, you know, for this week. Okay. Now, let's finish this thought, though, brethren, in verse 12. I know that there is nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good. Now, remember last week we circled those. I marked every one for you. I gave you every one. This is the good things in Ecclesiastes. 13 continues. Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. Tell yourself it's good, and now what? See that it's good. Figure out how it's good.
Now, there's one really obvious one, and we'll just hit the highlight there. You know, what is the most obvious good thing that comes from labor? Got to speak up. I'm deaf, and I'm not planning to hear you because I'm trying to teach you people to speak up. What?
My paycheck.
Your paycheck. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Okay, I shoot for something else. You're so right, but I was shooting for something else. Why do people buy treadmills? So they'll be healthier. So they'll be stronger. So they'll live longer. So they'll look better. See? And what is that? Pure labor. And when you're done, how far did you get? Still here? See? But is there good in the labor?
Good in the labor. Brother, I think there's a lot more good in the labor, and particularly in that kind of labor, because you can meditate in that time. You can pray in that time. I've been in these various athletic clubs,
and then I have a whole bookshelf there. So that when you come in, you can take a book off and put it on the treadmill in front of you. And while you're treadmill, what can you do? You read. They put televisions in front of them for the same reason. Can you have a lot of good out of that labor? Could you have a whole classroom there? Could you be listening to MP3s, plugged into your earbuds there? Look how valuable that could be.
There's so many ways that could be valuable. Value in the labor. Now then, in verse 14, I know that everything God does will remain forever. There's nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked that men should fear him. Did you know that? The nature of this earth is designed to call attention to God. And you know it. The heavens declare, David said, the glory of God. Okay? So then, he so worked that men would fear him. He's calling. All of Proverbs chapter 1 was wisdom, half of it was wisdom doing what? Calling. The world's tuned to do that. 15. That which is has been already, and that which will be has already been. Did you know that God seeks what has passed by? Do you know what is an inherent part of his nature? That there be stability and consistency, and that he wants in the future what had been in the past. This is a part of God's nature, that consistency. Eternity is a long time. Is God changing throughout all of it? Jesus Christ, fill in the blank. The same. Today, and forever. Okay? So in 15, that which has been already. That which will be has already been. God seeks what's passed by. Furthermore, I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there is wickedness, and in the place of righteousness there is wickedness. So yeah, I've seen that. I said to myself, because he was seeing that, thinking about it, he concluded, 17, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every matter, and for every deed is there. So, brethren, sometimes you look and you see a thing that is just wrong. And if you watch any video from a news program today, you saw a real wrong thing. What did you see that was real wrong on video today? That policeman fired five slugs into the
Well, he hit it five times. He fired eight. I think he hit it five times and killed an obese 50-year-old guy that he could have run down 16 times. The cop is fit and you can see it. And this guy is lumbering away, you know, he's just all out of shape. And that cop took a stance and he fired eight rounds and killed him dead, all five of them in his back. And today it's all on video. And by the end of the day, what's going on with that cop? He still got a job? No. And he's up for murder charges. They gonna prove him guilty? Pretty sure. Pretty sure. Especially after Ferguson and all the rest of that, the police would need to offer somebody up, and he's a good candidate. But the guy as guilty as he could be. You cannot do that by anybody's rule of law. It was just outrageously wrong. Now, I don't know what happened out of the screen. If you haven't been paying attention to this, there's 4.5 minutes that are outside the screen. There's 4.5 minutes between the cop calling to say he's engaging this guy and then the man showing up on that video you saw. What did go on for 4.5 minutes? I don't know. But whatever it was, it didn't justify what he did. But it might have caused him to get real mad. It might explain why he behaved in such a totally unacceptable manner. Okay? Sometimes cops do wrong things. Had it happened to me once. Ask me later. I was totally innocent. Guy lied to me. Threatened me. Said he was going to put me in cuffs and throw me in the back of his car. I was as innocent as the pure driven snake. Yes, I was. Okay? I'll tell you that sometime.
My point is, Sullivan sees it. And then he says, at 17, God will judge. God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man. That'll give you pause. For a time for every matter and for every deed is there. Now what that says is, there can be an unrighteousness and it'll be a long time before you see that thing get fixed, before you see justice. You might have these out of order long time, but there is a time, and the time will come. Wisdom, knowledge, understands to wait for God's time. I said to myself in verse 18 concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. He wants us to get real humble here, and he intended for us to figure this out. 19, fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there's no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust. All return to the dust. Now, stop right there. Very important you don't look at the next verse yet. It's kind of a real confusing verse, and I'm not sure I got it sorted out yet myself. It takes a lot of wisdom to get up to Solomon's level here. You know, he's calling to us, not saying we're going to get it immediately. But look, he wants us to figure out in verse 18 that you are what? Last word in the verse. You're a beast. That's all you are. You're just an animal like any other. Now get that. Now in 19, this is because of your fate. And a great length there, and concluding in verse 20, very poetically, where are we all going? From your dog to you. From worms to people. Where is everybody going? Dust. All you were, and back you go. Now, comes 21. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward and the breath of the beast descends downward to the earth? There's a great problem with this verse. That verse can be read as a statement with a period rather than a question mark, so that it is teaching you something that most people don't know, but Solomon wants you to know. He's trying to say in that case then, most people don't know this, few people know, The breath of man goes up, the breath of beast goes down. Now you know. Or he could be saying, who knows? It could be a rhetorical question in which you are intended to conclude, well, I don't. Solomon didn't either. So I don't know whether that's true or not. Jimmy, I'll get you in just a second. And then there's a third way to understand this, which is that that statement in verse 21, that the breath goes up and the breath goes down, should be read as a question that is intended as a rhetorical question to which you would conclude the breaths do not do that. Man's breath does not go up and beats go down. You've got three options here, and it's real hard to tell which one it is. Now, Jimmy first.
Okay,
she says chapter 12, verse 7 gives the answer to one of those. So everybody turn, and 12, 7 says, the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the Spirit will return to God who gave it. Remember? Same word, translated what? Spirit or breath or air or wind. Okay, now Jimmy's right. 12:7. What is also right in verse 19 from chapter 3? There's no difference. He started off by saying, there is no difference. And the question becomes, is he only talking about material physicality that were the same with animals? And there is a distinction between the two breaths, which now be translated spirits instead of breaths, and that the spirit goes up, which we know it does in 12:7, but an animal doesn't. I don't know. I used to think I did. I'm not so sure anymore. I mean, I'm sure there is a right way of the three, and I'm not sure I know which it is. Okay? We'll start there next week and see if you've thought about it, and we'll get some feedback on it. Was it three, I think? Do beasts have breath?
Yes.
Okay. So we still have a problem, don't we? It's how to translate the verse, and not just with the words themselves, but also, you know, with whether or not it deserves a question, a statement. Go ahead. Sure. And, well, physically, that seems to be the case, you know, in the context, I think, certainly. So I'm going to leave it with you, but we'll do the one last verse there. It's just a problem for me in 21. It's probably my own failing. I'm happy to admit it. 22, I've seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for that is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? You don't know what's coming. There's a time for everything. It'll all be turned upside down next week. You wait and see. Because that's the way the cycles work. It all is vanity and striving after wind. Okay? Do you have a hand up?
Man's Search for Meaning.
That's it. Viktor Frankl's book is called Man's Search for Meaning. It is one of the great classics in literature. That's the way it was introduced to me. Man's Search for Meaning. Little tiny book. Fascinating reading. Okay. Well, any last comment or question?